I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. The dawn of the atomic age ricocheted around the world. It even found its way to Hollywood. On today's program, the DVD gurus are back with their picks about the bomb. From government propaganda films assuring citizens there was nothing to fear, to imagining the impact of a bomb dropped in the 1980s, to, need I say it, mutant ants. Get under your desks. It's all our worst nuclear nightmares brought to life on the screen on Up to Date, following this hour's news. Up to Date, I'm Steve Kraske. The dawn of the atomic age was a pretty big deal, and you can bet that Hollywood took notice. Today, a conversation about how the bomb changed the movies, and yes, we'll be talking about mutant ants. We'll also talk about Dr. Strangelove, The Atomic Cafe, the film Them, and one titled Threads. Our DVD gurus are back in the house. They are Mitch Bryan. He's a screenwriter, playwright, UMKC film prof, and writer for 435 Magazine. Mitch, how are you?
I'm great. It's good to see you.
Man, Jason Heck just grows your resume.
Yeah. Look at just bigger and
mercenary
bigger.
Leader, jetpack developer. What can
Jason
he do?
Heck reviews films for the Kansas City Star. Jason, how are you?
Diminished.
Yeah.
That's how I am.
Just a little bit.
The incredible shrinking DVD guru.
Yeah. Look at this Mitch of all trades over here.
The Atomic Age, how did that this show come about, Mitch?
Do you want to tell
us,
Jason?
Well, I had cloudy memories of a movie called Matinee, directed by Joe Dante, who Mitch and I both like. He's a guy who did all sorts of great movies, like things like Rock and Roll High School and Gremlins. And the movie is sort of a loving look back at movies of the late 50s and early 60s set against the comical backdrop of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Well, it turns out the movie was a bit but Mitch started kicking around the idea and said, well, you know, there are so many movies out there that have to do with the atomic age, capital A. Why don't we make ourselves a little show about that? And honestly, the more I thought about it and the more I looked at the possible movies that we could include, the better it got. So,
and the bomb, obviously, Mitch, this was a pretty big deal back in the day. We sort of forget today, but it was.
I think that was one of the things that is mentioned in one of the films we'll be talking about, The Day After Trinity, that there's no way to really imagine, unless you were there, the kind of, one, patriotic fervor that existed as the Second World War happened, you know, and the country pulled itself together to fight a war on two fronts and to create this amazing sort of power. And the whole process of the Manhattan Project and the development of the bomb was almost like making science fiction a reality. I mean, mm-hmm. these are things that no one had ever really thought even possible. And it began to sort of overwhelm the consciousness of the country for the next, you know, 35, 40 years, because not only is there the whole thing that happened in the 50s in the wake of the A-bomb and the hydrogen bomb, but then in the 1980s, we got really close to serious nuclear problems. I mean, was it 83 when somebody almost pushed the button, right?
It was 83. There was a Soviet, I guess at the time, colonel got a launch warning that U.S. Minuteman missiles were being launched, and everybody sort of, you know, their automatic retaliatory capacity was sort of swinging into action. He said, wait a minute. I think someone just sneezed on the radar and sort of stopped it. But it was – they got a false positive from one of their satellites, this thing called the OCO system that uses infrared. And it said that there were heat blooms from U.S. missile silos. And he said, wait a minute. We've had some problems with this before. And sort of tech support saved the day at that point.
If it hadn't been for a clear-thinking general in Russia, we might have been in trouble.
We might very well have been, yeah.
Is there one film that sort of personifies what we're talking about here today?
Well, we're looking at different films from different eras. You know, for sheer terror in America circa the 1980s, obviously The Day After, which was watched by 100 million people, and I'll be talking about that.
That was filmed Lawrence, Kansas
City.
That was
Lawrence, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, taking it right on the chin. But, you know, there's sort of our love affair with the bomb sort of turned to fear when the hydrogen bomb came around, because the atomic bomb was, if you look at Hiroshima, it was one plane, one city, and it was 20,000 tons of TNT. That's what the bomb was. It was 20 kilotons. When we get to the hydrogen bomb, we look at megatons. So you go from a city obliterated with 20,000 tons of TNT to a bomb that is 15 million tons of high explosive. That's the equivalent. So you start looking at things like Rhode Island being destroyed by one plane. And we started to get a lot more dubious about the bomb. At that point, and by then the Russians had exploded theirs in 49, so we no longer had a monopoly on it. And it became less this benevolent guardian of peace and goodness as something that, as one character in a movie says, the atomic genie has been let out of the bottle. We have unleashed something that may be good, but do we have total control over it? What's going to happen in the future?
You know, people forget sometimes, even when we were kids, maybe not so much you, Jason, but when we were kids, they used to have these things in elementary school where you go out in the hallway and sit on the floor and stick your head between your knees. And I'm not really sure why we all did that, but clearly it was for something like an atomic bomb going off somewhere.
This,
not that that would have helped any.
This naive belief that you can duck and cover and somehow avoid
what was that all about?
You know, the nuclear fallout and everything.
But the
else.
Point is, it was always this sort of scary aura around doing all these things. You didn't really know why you were doing it, but you were doing it and what could happen here. And it was kind of creepy.
Yeah, absolutely. Creating a false sense of security because everybody was probably so terrified of what they knew would really happen that they've got to figure out a way to sort of pacify the masses with the notion that by ducking and covering, you'll be able to save yourself.
Yeah. Now, Jason, you never did that before, did you?
No, I always
never had a duck and cover.
No, I mostly had in the basement during tornado warnings. But even then, I had a TV and Nintendo, and it wasn't that bad. But no canned food or anything. No civil defense crackers.
Fallout shelter signs all over. Do you remember those?
Remember, I used to get kits to how to build your own shelter. We thought it'd be a cool Ford. And that was just what you did back in those days.
That's
you
right. If you could just rig your couch up and put the sheet over your head, you'll be fine in Fort Safety, right? No girls allowed.
Exactly. Yeah. Your little 3-foot hole in the ground, which took you 4 weeks to dig.
In the Atomic Cafe, one of the movies I'm going to be talking about, there's a professor. They sort of juxtapose two scenes. One is this sort of oldish professor type talking to some sort of girls' school. He said, let's take a 20 megaton surface burst. How far would you have to be? And he sort of lays out safety. And then we cut to this professor from Columbia who said it would be he characterizes it desperately futile to build a bomb shelter to think that anything could save you from a 20 megaton nuclear weapon. It was the height of futility.
Jason just showed me an app on his smartphone that you can plug in your address and then choose one of, I don't know, 30 different options of different sizes of nuclear bombs that have been set off.
Yeah,
you push a button and it will tell you how much will be destroyed, where the fallout will fall, and needless to say,
you would have something
Fairway,
like that.
Kansas, you know, did not do well when we tried it out.
Is that
yesterday,
right?
Yeah. I am currently looking for a girlfriend, just so you know. No, it's an app that lets you try various yields of bombs all the way from Trinity, which is 19.
Now, why are you interested in that?
I like history stuff. Yeah. And my interest was sparked by having watched some of these movies. You know, the Russians exploded the biggest bomb ever, 57 megatons. Called the Tsar Bomba, yes, as in the Tsar. And what that would do is you can't even imagine what it would do. And in fact, they said up to the point from 45 to 57, when they exploded the Tsar Bomba, it represented half of the fallout of all the nuclear testing that had been done at that point, just one bomb. So to even factor that in is the kind of power that we have, it's mind-boggling. And so, yeah, there was an app out there. Hundreds of thousands of apps, folks. And I got it. And, I will be honest and say that Fairway didn't come out too good.
Okay. We're talking with our DVD gurus about the films that represent the atomic age. Let's go to our first one here, Jason, and it's called Them.
It is called Them. And Them is
one word.
It is Them with an exclamation point. It's a Warner Brothers movie. It's easy to dismiss initially as a monster movie. But it is sort of – it's easy to dismiss Godzilla as a monster movie too, but Godzilla has a lot going on. Them also has some good stuff going on. It was definitely on the B list at Warner Brothers. It was not an expensive movie. It stars James Arness and Edmund Gwenn and James Whitmore. And it starts off like a really compelling murder mystery. We have some New Mexico state cops and an FBI agent investigating some mysterious disappearances in the New Mexico desert. And about a third of the way in, we have some entomologists, a father-daughter team from the Department of Agriculture who show up. And we discover that these murders are being caused by gigantic ants that have been mutated by the first atomic bomb 9 years ago. And
How big are the ants?
9 to 12 feet long.
Okay.
No, I mean, they're a car.
Buick size.
Buicks, yeah.
It's going to take more than Muhammad Ali and his decon to take these guys out. And they have turned carnivorous because there isn't much going on in the New Mexico desert, and they have started eating people.
Don't blame them.
They go into the nest, and they burn it out and use cyanide, but two queen ants escape. And so the movie suspense engine kicks into high gear. As the military has to do this sort of covert search, they can't warn anybody for these queen ants who are going to spawn new nests somewhere, and a final showdown occurs in the sewers of Los Angeles. it's great. It is a terrific movie. The suspense.
How do the ants look?
Really good.
All these years later.
I mean, okay, look. Anybody raised on a diet of digital special effects and the effortless wizardry of modern movie special effects is going to think they look hokey.
Mm-hmm.
There is a charm to them. They are obviously big mechanical things, but they were nominated.
It reminds you of your childhood too, probably.
If my childhood was 1954, yes. But it is. It was nominated for an Academy Award for its special effects.
Really?
And nominated for an Academy Award for sound. It's really, really, really good. It is a really excellent suspense film. It is very lean. There is no fat in the movie. Everything that happens happens for a purpose and moves the plot forward in a very elegant way. Whitmore is great. He's sort of the New Mexico state trooper whose partner gets eaten and who's sort of got a score to settle. Arness, all 6'5" of him, is our FBI guy. We have the very foxy Joan Weldon as the 23-year-old Dr. Medford. And, of course, Edmund Gwenn, Santa Claus himself from Miracle on 34th Street, is her father, Dr. Medford. It's important because the movie is the first real one that really calls into debate the wisdom of the atomic bomb. And because these monsters are created by the bomb,
But with that said, what's great about them is that it calls into question the wisdom of the atomic bomb, but it makes it very clear that all of us working together can defeat anything that comes our way. So scientists actually get along with the military, get along with the FBI, get along with law enforcement, whereas as you go through these movies in the 50s, you start to see a schism. And some of these movies fall into the camp where the military has all the answers and the scientists aren't to be trusted, versus the other version, which is the scientists have all the answers and the military are too trigger happy. And so it's really interesting to watch how this all started with everybody kind of working together on this one. And then as the 50s would go on, you'll start seeing these camps emerge in these movies.
Everybody's buddy-buddy, mostly because the two scientists who are involved are not atomic scientists. They're entomologists. They're people who are, you know, their interest is ants, and these ants have become gigantic. And so they're going to have some of the answers. But what's interesting about this movie is it sort of spawned a lot of inferior imitations, like Tarantula in 1955, the Deadly Mantis in 1957.
Yes.
And them, when you look at these movies about giant bugs, it's a way for us to sort of face the atomic menace without having to face the terrible bomb itself. The bomb,
That's
an atomic bomb, is too remote and too titanic for us to deal with. But if we band together and we do what the military tells us to, not unlike duck and cover, and we listen to scientists who have the knowledge, then we can defeat this menace spawned by the bomb. And it's sort of it's a catharsis for us to deal with our terror That's about the bomb.
What's the clip we have from them?
Well, we have this a really good clip. We have our folks have gone out into the desert, Dr. Medford and FBI agent Graham and Sergeant Peterson, and they have just found a track of one of the ants, which is this really bizarre track, like what kind of footprints do ants have? And Dr. Medford is questioned by these men, and he's deciding to kind of give them a hint about what he's thinking.
This is monstrous.
So is the disappearance and murder of five people, Doctor.
Yeah. The direction of that print would indicate it came from that way. Perhaps we should visit the store. There may be more there now.
Now look here, Dr. Mitford, before we do any more visiting any place, I want to know exactly what this it is.
Gentlemen, I understand your impatience. I know you two are concerned with solving what is essentially a local crime, but please believe me, I am not being coy with you. No. If I'm wrong in my assumptions, then no harm has been done. But if I am correct, and the mounting evidence only fortifies my theory, then something incredible has happened in this desert. In which case, none of us will dare risk revealing it, because none of us can risk a nationwide panic.
A panic?
I remember that film now, watching it as a kid.
It's really, funny. Really good. Yeah. It holds up. It's really good.
That film is Them. We're visiting with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan, Jason Heck. We're talking about films that are reflective of the atomic age and the bomb. Mitch Bryan, talk to us about Shrinking Man.
The incredible Shrinking Man from 1957. So by this time, the bomb had gotten a little scarier. And the film is really, I think, a meditation on what happens when America, at the height of its power, is reduced by this, you know, this invisible, uncontrollable force. And it takes the form of a radioactive cloud that our hero, Scott Carey, is out on he's out boating with his wife, and she goes downstairs to get a beer. And as he looks up, he sees this sort of cloud come out of nowhere, and it wafts over him. And before you know it, poor Scott is starting to shrink. And there are a lot of consequences when you're shrinking. And here he is, a businessman.
What are those consequences?
Well,
Mitch?
You know, just start thinking about it. You know, think about how that's going to affect your marriage. and it certainly does. He's got a great wife. She's supportive of him.
But he's a tiny man.
But he's shrinking. Yeah. And his own feelings of himself and his prowess and the shame that comes with getting smaller and smaller takes a terrible toll on this poor guy. And eventually, unfortunately, Butch the cat becomes less than a pet and more of a predator, and to the point where everybody thinks that Butch the cat has eaten this poor guy. And unbeknownst to everyone, he's trapped in the basement where there are giant spiders and all sorts of other things that he's got to fight. So on one hand, you know, it's a very direct metaphor about, you know, the loss of male power and also the loss of kind of the threat of American power. It's an amazing movie, and it works, and it moves like lightning. So many of these great old Universal pictures are so fast. And it is a portrait of America in the 50s as well, and what is deemed to be the proper male-female relationship in the 1950s household, leave it to Beaver kind of world.
So the film was made for the gender war thing, or was it made because of America losing power with other countries having the bomb?
And I'm sure that the answer to that would be, it's not about any of those things.
Yes.
It's just about a guy who's shrinking.
Yeah,
you know, and you can read into it what you want, but it carries with it a really famous quote where he says, you know, to God there is no zero, and I will, you know, continue shrinking into the infinite, you know, and face new adventures and new worlds. And so it has this really existential message kind of at the center of it. It's wildly entertaining. I particularly like the part where he is so frustrated that he runs off and runs into a circus performer who's the world's tiniest girl.
Oh.
And they have a little relationship until he shrinks smaller than her. You know, poor guy just can't catch a break.
Oh, that's funny. this film was made what year?
1957.
And what's the clip we have?
So here is a scene between husband and wife where she is doing her best to support him and buck him up, even though
during his tough time.
They just got into the car and he's starting to realize he maybe need to have blocks under his feet to be able to drive the car. He can't even drive his beautiful, you know, Studebaker or whatever. So,
all right,
Luis, I want you to start thinking about us. Our marriage. Some awful things might happen. There's a limit to your obligation.
Oh, now, wait a minute. Look, I love you. Don't you know that?
You love Scott Carey. He has a size and a shape and a way of thinking. All that's changing now.
Not a darn thing's changed. I know I haven't. When I married you, I meant what I said. And as long as you've got this wedding ring on, you've got me. Come on now, let's go home.
but she can't protect him from the kitty. She can't protect him from the spiders. Come on.
And that sound was his ring falling off of his finger she says, as long as you got that ring, I'm with you. And then the finger, you know, shrinking finger.
Why does he wind up in the basement?
He's running away from Butch the Cat. And he tumbles downstairs, and then she gets home and thinks Butch the Cat ate him and doesn't think to go look in the basement. So everybody writes him off. It's all over the news. The Incredible Shrinking Man has died. They don't say why. They don't want to expose that to scandal. But he's become a national celebrity by this point, and everybody assumes he's dead.
At the end of the scene with the car, she picks him up, takes him home, tucks him in his little sock drawer, and
He's living in a dollhouse by the time Butch the Cat attacks. Yeah, it's great. You got to see this movie.
Well, again, we're talking about films this morning that reflect the atomic age. And if you want to join our conversation, perhaps with a recommendation from a film that you recall from those days or even more modern times when the film was discussed a whole lot, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Okay, Jason Heck, how about Atomic Cafe?
How about the Atomic Cafe?
How about it?
You should eat there. The Atomic Cafe is a documentary film of stunning black humor. I mean, gallows humor out the wazoo. Directed by Jane Loader and the brothers Kevin and Pierce Rafferty, it's from 1984. And they spent 5 years, they formed a group called the Archives Project, and they spent 5 years culling U.S. government films. And I mean films of U.S. Army training films and civil defense films.
There were millions of them.
The government viewed film as a great teacher, and the theater as, you know, we could show these kids movies and show our soldiers movies and our government officials and tell them what to do. Well, they juxtaposed these. They edited in what Jane Loader refers to as a compilation verite, whereas there is no God voice. There is no real narrator. They just sort of edit these clips in such a way that we can see how absurd they are. And the soundtrack is basically atomic-themed pop songs. So you have songs with titles like Atomic Love, This Cold War With You, Jesus Hits Like an Atom Bomb.
We should play some of those.
You know, I looked for them, there was a great sound. They put the soundtrack out, but due to rights issues, it was never reissued. So I sort of did a big search for them, thinking that we could listen to some of them today, but no go. You know, anybody who lived through the 50s and 60s, these are going to be very familiar. There's Bert the Turtle instructing us on how to duck and cover. if you were in the military, you're going to see all these films telling you how to deal with attacking directly into an atomic explosion that has been used to rip a hole through enemy lines. You know, we've got Eisenhower. We've got a very moving section where there's an interview with a man who watched Ethel Rosenberg being executed and talking about how she took more jolts than her husband. You know, it's a great examination of how rich we were after the war, too. We have a lot of photos of, you know, these happy couples in their Studebaker Starlight Commanders on Lover's Lane listening to Eisenhower give his speeches. But Eisenhower is very circumspect. You know, you realize that maybe it's a good idea to have a guy who's led millions of troops in battle because he knows about warfare. And he gives some pretty good speeches about how we have perhaps evolved beyond, you know, he says in one lifetime, from 1860 to 1950, we've gone from the musket to the hydrogen bomb. And he said that kind of power, are we really ready to deal with it? And it's nice to have a president ask these questions. And you think, you know, Ike was maybe a little bit deeper than we thought he was.
Yeah, right, right.
But, you know, it's very scathing in the stuff it depicts. It, you know, Army films saying, you know, well, if your biggest worry is radiation, your hair's going to grow back. Don't worry. Same cowlick, same style. Don't, you know, it's called,
really?
Oh yeah. It's called nucleosis, and you shouldn't be afraid of it. It's just, you know, pressure from society and worries, but we've got it handled. And, you know, footage of houses built in Denver with 8-inch concrete basements, you know, for civil defense certified basements, but might just be the perfect place for the harried housewife to get a little quiet from the kids.
Wow.
So, you know, you've got this frantic push toward consumerism and enriching our lives with all this production that ramped up during the war now being converted to civilian use. But at the same time, we're sort of whistling in the dark about the bomb, you know, about these, because there's nobody has a snowball's chance in hell of surviving a hydrogen bomb. You just don't. And yet, you know, I made my son this flannel suit that has a layer of shredded lead to absorb radiation so he can play on the playground in Fallout. Really?
Hmm.
Really? It's gripping viewing, and it's as a portrait of doublethink. It is pretty much unparalleled. It's a terrific film.
What's the clip here we have from Atomic Cafe?
This is this is really wrenching. This is a training film that depicts the beginning of what's called Troop Test Smokey. And Troop Test Smokey is this atomic shot that's going to go off at the Nevada test range, and our infantry are going to rise up from their trenches and walk toward the mushroom cloud. And these guys are – one of these privates is having some second thoughts, and he is being consoled by a chaplain played by arguably the worst actor you've ever heard, who is clearly reading off of cue cards during his entire performance. But it's pretty great.
What seems to be the trouble, soldier? You look a little bit worried.
Well, I am, Chaplain. Just a little bit.
Actually, there's no need to be worried, as the Army has taken all of the necessary precautions to see that we're perfectly safe here.
Sir, have you ever been out on one of these shots before?
Yes, I've had the opportunity to see a number of the atomic tests. I feel that as a chaplain, it is my responsibility to be with my men.
What's it like, Chaplain?
First of all, one sees a very, very bright light, followed by a shock wave, and then you hear the sound of the blast, and then it seems as though there's a minor earthquake. And then you look up and you see the fireball as it ascends up into the heaven. It's a wonderful sight to behold.
I could do better than that.
Not an actor.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's clearly a real U.S. Army chaplain reading off a cue card. But that's the kind of thing that the movie does so well. It shows you things that were completely serious and without irony, and you just can't help but hold your sides and howl at how oblivious we really were to the real danger.
Hmm. We're talking about films stemming from the atomic age this morning with our DVD gurus. Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. Kevin from Prairie Village, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I had a couple that I thought I'd mention.
Yeah.
The movie Failsafe, I would regard, I guess, as an atomic movie that I found very disturbing as a kid when I saw that film. And then also the movie On the Beach, about the end of life in Australia after the world's gone through a nuclear holocaust. And the last one's a little obscure. I think I've got the name right, but I think it's called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. And it's a bunch of people who survive a nuclear blast in New York City, and it's like two men and a woman, and they're running around the streets of New York, and everything's completely empty.
And one of them is Harry Belafonte, which brought a rather interesting note of race into the movie. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, Failsafe's a favorite of mine. Mitch and I kicked it around. For me, it's even scarier than Dr. Strangelove because it's not a madman who does it. It's a simple switch that shorts out that basically results in it. And I think Failsafe's terrific. If Strangelove had never existed, Failsafe would be regarded as, I think, a pretty impressive film. But, you know, it's sort of coming out in the shadows of one of the greatest classics of the era. It's sort of overlooked. But it's a terrific film. Henry Fonda is the president. Larry Hagman is his translator. It's awful good.
Yeah, it's a very compelling movie. The tenseness of everything keeps just building and building and building, and the ultimate disaster happens in the end.
Yeah, with that terrific montage of clips, and then the film melts. It's got some oomph for sure.
Yeah. Hey,
thanks for calling, Kevin.
All right.
Kay from Overland Park also mentioned On the Beach as the most memorable movie for her. Let's go to Reggie from Leawood. Reggie, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
It's a great show. I thought of one that was probably a little out of your scope, but it hits right there. The Iron Giant. I think it was made in the early 90s.
Sure, that'd be Brad Bird made that, and it's a pretty great look at Cold War America. Christopher McDonald is awesome as the government agent.
Yes. Now, in that movie, there's a scene where the kids are in school, and they show them a little film on what to do when the atomic bomb hits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I thought would tie into your discussion there. And it just was a really interesting film. I thought it was nostalgic as far as the 50s, what was going on in that time, in that time era.
An overlooked classic. It has sort of faded a little bit, but it's a great movie.
Okay.
Yes.
Reggie, thanks.
Thank you.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our gurus about films reflecting the atomic age. We'll turn to Dr. Strangelove, Day After, Threads, and Trinity. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. This music is from where?
It's from the War of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds, okay. If you missed our conversations yesterday with Paul Durrell talking about living the artist's life, or with Kansas City native and jazz vocalist Kevin Mahogany, or if you're looking for Brian McTavish's weekend to-do list, you can find all of that, and as well as our previous broadcasts, at kcur.org. On Monday, we asked if the content of our public libraries represents the diversity of our communities. But this hour, we're talking with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, about films reflecting the atomic age. And if you want to join our conversation with your recommendations, we're open for business, 816-235-2888. Our email address, up-to-date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR up-to-date. Mitch, how about the classic, Dr. Strangelove?
Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, from 1964.
That's right.
Arguably, you know, the most famous critique of the atom bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And the story goes that Kubrick was interested in adapting this novel, Red Alert, which is similar to Failsafe. In fact, the author of Red Alert actually would wind up suing the author of Failsafe because thinking he'd ripped him off. But once he started doing all of the research, he was struck by the absurdity of the whole situation. And so this very serious thriller, much like Failsafe, was turned into this black comedy, because Kubrick said when he got to the point where he realized that people were talking about, you know, who could kill the most millions of civilians, you know, which side would win if one side kills 20 million people and the other side kills 100 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion that so much of this is reliant upon this series of steps, any one of which could be screwed up by human error and kick the whole thing, you know, out of control.
Right.
So he creates this scenario, this doomsday scenario, where a general named Jack D. Ripper, who's obsessed with fluoridation and the fear of losing his precious bodily fluids, goes mad, seals off the Air Force base, and orders the wing command to attack Russia, and everything that sort of falls out of that. He winds up defending the base against his own troops, you know, that are sent in to get him.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation just rapidly escalates with all sorts of comic possibilities and comic performances by George C. Scott, and of course Slim Pickens, and Peter Sellers playing three roles, playing Dr. Strangelove, the president, and group captain Lionel Mandrake.
And it's a great movie. Why? Or it's regarded that way?
It's great on every level, which is probably why it's a great movie. The filmmaking is absolutely impeccable and bold and visually arresting. The script is really funny and sharp and knowing. The performances across the board are impeccable. The recreation of the bomber was so precise that Kubrick was afraid they were going to get investigated by the FBI, because his production people went out and did all this research.
Wow.
And they created this absolutely perfect mock-up of this bomber, and the military couldn't figure out how they managed to do that.
Wow.
So, it was clearly made without the cooperation of the military. But everything about the movie is just sort of pitch perfect, and the production design is magnificent and spectacular and big and beautiful. And, you know, like all of Stanley Kubrick's films, they have these, I think, really profound themes and a pretty acerbic attitude, and at the same time, they always function as great pieces of entertainment. And you know, that was for a guy who made such important movies. He always wanted to entertain. He always wanted to make money with his pictures. And mm-hmm. I think that this is a film you can watch over and over and over again, and it never, ever gets old. I don't know how many times I've seen this movie, and it makes me laugh every time.
Oh, that's
and amazing. You notice these little details, just like Jason pointed out, that all the guys in the bomber are just eating all the time. And it's just like so kind of – there's so much humor that comes out of just mundane human behavior in the movie.
Yeah.
For all the big laughs in it, like George C. Scott's mugging and whatnot, you know, we were – Mitch and I watched it on Wednesday night, and you know, we were going to watch Threads, but due to technical difficulties, we couldn't quite pull that off. And so he put in Strangelove, and I sort of in the back of my head thought, man, I've seen this movie 20 times, and yet I'm still laughing. And I'm noticing little things like in the war room, all, you know, with, I don't know, 60 civilians and generals, they've all got their briefing books, their SAC, Strategic Air Command briefing books. And George C. Scott has one that on the binder it says statistics in mega deaths. Like mega deaths. And so you get why, you know, it's all these absurd little touches. And yeah, all six members of Major Kong's B-52 are constantly stuffing themselves with like cookies, and they've got little paper cups, and you know, or they're reading porn, or they're reading a paperback, or practicing card tricks. But it's, yeah, watching all of them, even while they're giving radio reports, shoving like Twinkies into their mouths. It just keeps growing on you. And it's such a great movie.
Did it do well at the box office when it came out?
Killed poor Failsafe, that's for sure.
It did kill Failsafe, but it also helped that Kubrick had sued Failsafe and to slow down the production of it. But what happened was it was a hit, but it also it was a hit with a certain group of people. There was a certain generation many of whom would become filmmakers and would become, you know, the real thinkers of the day, who just loved the movie. And then there was another part of the audience who just was not willing to go there. It was so radical in how darkly funny it was. So it had to build, you know. But it was mm-hmm. But it was certainly famous from the moment that it came out.
Mitch pointed out to me, you know, the obvious thing, which we don't really think about, but nobody had ever seen a movie like Dr. Strangelove when it came out.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there
had you don't make comedies like that. I mean, Billy Wilder would at times make comedies that would work this really fine line between, you know, darkly humorous and sort of serious, and you kind of sometimes with the film like Sunset Boulevard, you weren't quite sure where you were sitting at times.
Yeah.
But nobody had ever seen anything like this.
What's the clip we have from Dr. Strangelove?
This is a terrific scene between George C. Scott, who's General Buck Turgidson, who is based on Curtis LeMay, who is a real hawk, giving the stats to the president about how maybe they ought to just let this nuclear thing happen and we could win.
General, it is the avowed policy of our country never to strike first with nuclear weapons.
Well, Mr. President, I would say that General Ripper has already invalidated that policy.
That was not an act of national policy, and there are still alternatives left open to us.
Mr. President, we are rapidly approaching a moment of truth, both for ourselves as human beings and for the life of our nation. Now, truth is not always a pleasant thing. But it is necessary now to make a choice, to choose between two admittedly regrettable but nevertheless distinguishable post-war environments. One where you got 20 million people killed and the other where you got 150 million people killed.
You're talking about mass murder, General, not war.
Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, but I do say no more than 10 to 20 million killed, tops, depending on the breaks.
I will not go down in history as the greatest mass murderer since Adolf Hitler.
Perhaps it might be better, Mr. President, if you were more concerned with the American people than with your image in a history book.
There you go. David from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome.
Hi. I saw that movie, Dr. Strangelove, in 2001 in a movie theater in Helsinki, Finland. And the audience was mostly university-aged people. And the movie was put on by the U.S. Embassy there in Helsinki. It was quite interesting to see the difference in the responses of the audience members. For example, I thought it was a riot. It was hilarious. But some members of the audience took it very seriously. And, you know, Finland is right on the edge there of Russia. So they have a very different attitude toward those things than we do.
That's it. People do have different reactions to this film, as you said,
absolutely.
Mitch. Yeah. Great phone call, David. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Neil from Olathe. Neil, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Yeah, there's some great lines in that movie. The one where after they realize it's a mistake, you know, George C. Scott says, "Well, I don't think it's fair to condemn the whole program just on one mistake." And then, of course, I think the greatest line of the whole movie is, "Gentlemen, you can't fight in here; it's the war room."
That's right.
Yeah. That's a great deal. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye bye. Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about films reflecting the atomic age with our DVD gurus. They are Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. And Jason, you're up next with a twin bill, mm-hmm. Day After and the movie Threads, two of them.
Yeah, this was the early 80s, and we had Ronald Reagan ascend to the White House on a platform of rebuilding America's defenses, and he began in earnest. We had the B-1 bomber, we had the MX missile, and he did something very provocative. He deployed Pershing missiles and ground-launched cruise missiles to Europe. Right on the Soviet border, so they would have almost no warning. So he ratchets things up dramatically with Chairman Andropov at the time. So all of a sudden, we are put in an not quite as scary as 1962, but tensions are ratcheted up. And the world responds by A, being terrified, but B, this is where you start seeing huge marches in Europe. We have trade unions striking to really try and make a statement that this sort of what they view as warmongering won't be tolerated. So the U.S. and British media respond with two very similar but very different movies. In the U.S., we have The Day After, which is very famous in this town because Kansas City was obliterated in a nuclear weapon in The Day After, and it was also filmed in Lawrence, Kansas. You had some sort of familiar faces, Jo Beth Williams, Steve Guttenberg, Jason Robards, John Lithgow, showing up. And we have Nicholas Meyer, who had just directed Star Trek The Wrath of Khan, arguably the best of the Star Trek films, came in, and he had this – he wanted to make a movie that was gutsy and that was terrifying. Well, ABC said, "We're going to air it over two nights." And he said, "No, you'll air it over one night." And they said, "Okay, but it's going to be 4 hours long." He said, "No, my final cut will be 2 hours and 20 minutes." And he wanted it all – he wanted no commercials. He wanted some oomph. Well, about 12 minutes of footage ended up being too scary, too controversial, and was removed and exists somewhere. But what aired was watched by 100 million people.
Mm.
It was big. It was like the last episode of MASH. It was huge.
Right.
And here in Kansas City, they set up essentially grief counselors to help people deal with it. The University of Kansas English Department formed a group called Let Lawrence Live.
Wow.
Mr. Rogers aired four episodes to help children who had watched The Day After. It was a big deal, and it was a very immediate deal. No one had ever depicted nuclear holocaust on America's heartland before. We had seen test footage of bombs going off in the desert or at Bikini Atoll or whatever. But this was the obliteration of a city and of our, by default, the American way of life. Pretty good. Melodrama, but pretty good. Now we go over to Britain and the BBC, which has far fewer restrictions than ABC. And they make a movie that if The Day After was a slap in the face, Threads is a punch in the stomach and then a punch on the chin. It was devastating. It depicts the aftermath of 200 megatons worth of Soviet weaponry falling on Britain. Focuses on the town of Sheffield. Two major stories here. We have sort of a young couple. The girl has gotten pregnant, and they're sort of trying to figure out how to proceed and get married and get an apartment. And then we have the Sheffield City Council sort of being brought in for Britain's continuity of government program, where they assume London will be destroyed, so each city will sort of run itself. And we have people who are not trained taking on roles that they are not prepared for. So you have basically the equivalent of a city council trying to figure out how to store food, how to ration fuel, how to survive after a nuclear attack. Threads also goes much further than The Day After. It looks to what Britain would be like 13 years after the bombs had fallen. Mm. We have a population of between 4 and 11 million. We have kids who don't really speak any kind of English anymore. They speak a sort of pidgin because there are no schools anymore. Crops aren't going really anymore because way too many UV rays are getting in because the ozone layer has been torn up. There are no agrochemicals. There's no fertilizer. And the end of it ends up with this 13-year-old girl giving birth to something horrifying. she sort of looks down at this bundle in a woman's arms and starts to scream, and then you go to the end credits. So if The Day After has John Lithgow ending saying, "This is Lawrence, Kansas, is anybody out there?" Well, at least the hope exists that maybe somebody is. With Threads, even that is extinguished in a very brutal way. But it's sort of what people needed to hear. They needed to have their fears validated, and these movies did it in a huge way.
I'd forgotten just what a big deal Day After
was. Oh, I remember it, man. Yeah. I was 9, and it was so huge. I remember Larry Moore, the huge chunk of the newscast was devoted to after the show aired, to talking about, and interviews around town, and interviews with teachers, and how are you going to explain this to your students? And schools had special viewings of it. It was really, really, really big.
We have a clip here from the scarier of these two films, Threads.
Yeah, Threads is unrelenting, and this is a clip of a real British government film series called Protect and Survive that plays in the background of people's televisions as the government starts realizing that a war is coming, and they sort of broadcast these very practical and very grim programs on how to survive after a nuclear war.
If anyone dies while you are kept in your fallout room, move the body to another room in the house. Label the body with name and address, and cover it as tightly as possible in polythene, paper, sheets, or blankets. If, however, you have had a body in the house for more than 5 days, and if it is safe to go outside, then you should bury the body for the time being in a trench or cover it with earth and mark the spot of the burial.
There you go.
When you're hearing this from your government, you know something's about to hit the proverbial fan. It's terrifying.
Boy, that's pretty.
It's relentless and grim and terrifying.
Pretty sobering. Yeah. Okay. Well, Mitch Bryan, we are down to the final film of the morning here, Trinity.
The Day After Trinity, also known as J. Robert Oppenheimer and the Atomic Bomb, it is both a biography of Oppenheimer as well as the story of how the Atomic Bomb and the Manhattan Project came together, and also about the aftermath of Oppenheimer's not decline, but simply being pushed aside at a certain point where he took issue with the development of the hydrogen bomb, and he eventually lost all of his security clearance. Here's a guy who started out as really the single genius behind the creation of the atom bomb, a person who, despite their initial leftist political leanings, bohemian lifestyle, became sort of obsessed with making sure that this thing could happen and that it would be the weapon that would ultimately help win the war. Hmm. The scale of the Manhattan Project alone is sort of worth watching this thing just to get some sense of what it was like to take all of these amazing minds up to this one place and focus all of them on this task at hand. And these really were the most brilliant minds across America. And they were all young, and they created this world, this community up there. And so on one hand, you have all this sort of warmth and friendship dedicated towards this task of developing something that would become, you know, absolutely devastating. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's good about this film, and it was nominated for Academy Award in 1980, was there was a lot of declassified footage that they were able to get a hold of, archival footage that documented the process, and test footage that had never been seen before. It's a film that's a little dry, a little quiet in the way that it presents itself. You really realize that documentaries, there is kind of like the before Ken Burns and after Ken Burns, you know, and this was prior to that. But what you've really got going for it is the fact that these people who were interviewed were all there because these interviews were shot in the late 70s. So these people were still around. They were able to give you firsthand accounts of what the experience was like, of what these people were like. And it really does sort of bring it to life.
And what's the clip we have?
So
here?
In the clip here, this is a little bit of the statistics in the wake of the bomb being exploded. And then a quote from a physicist called Freeman Dyson, who I think creates a really interesting kind of finale to this discussion that we're having today.
This is from Trinity.
Since the Trinity blast in 1945, there have been more than 1,200 nuclear explosions on the face of the Earth. The largest has 4,000 times the force of the bomb that leveled Hiroshima.
I felt it myself. the glitter of nuclear weapons. It is irresistible if you come to them as a scientist, to feel it's there in your hands to release this energy that fuels the stars, to let it do your bidding, and to perform these miracles to lift a million tons of rock into the sky. It is something that gives people an illusion of illimitable power, and it is in some ways responsible for all our troubles, I would say. This, what you might call technical arrogance that overcomes people when they see what they can do with their minds.
Well, that's a note to go out on.
Kaboom.
Yeah, I don't like nerds lecturing me. That's all I'm saying. I use my bombs how I want to use my bombs, and that's that.
Tom from Overland Park asks if you've heard of Panic in the Year Zero, about a family surviving atomic attack in America.
Ray Milland. Yes, I have.
Good film?
Big finale in a cave, I believe. Okay film. Kind of unknown, but, you know, Ray Milland's always worth a watch, unless he's in Battlestar Galactica.
Alan posted on Facebook, I enjoyed the movies about SAC, the Strategic Air Command, and the whole thing about the U.S. being ready to defend. My favorites were Jimmy Stewart in Strategic Air Command, Bombers, B-52, and A Gathering of Eagles.
Bombers, B-52, directed by Gordon Douglas, who directed them. So he knew a thing or two about atomic what have you.
Tom in Overland Park called, with another title, The Mouse That Roared, with Peter Sellers.
I've actually never seen that movie.
Tiny country declares war on the United States. Not one of his funniest, but certainly absurd.
Okay, and George and Lawrence also recommends The Mouse That Roared.
They have it.
Yeah, okay. Hey, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Good way to spend an hour. Stay safe after that harrowing hour. Mitch Bryant is a screenwriter, playwright, UMKC film professor, and writer for 435 Magazine. Jason Heck reviews films for the Kansas City Star. You can learn more about our guests and get more information about our program at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. On Monday, we'll ask if the content of our public libraries represents the diversity of our communities, and you might be surprised at the answer. Our show's theme music normally is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble. Today's show was produced by Danny Alexander. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.